Welcome to another episode of Niels Rewinds. My name is Anne Vermaurik and today I speak with Rachel Gillett, who is Assistant Professor in Cultural History at Utrecht University, teaching Modern Europe and Empire. Welcome, Rachel. Very good to have you on the show. In this episode of Niels Rewinds, we're going to talk about your fascinating new book, Race, Music and Cultural Politics in Interwar Paris, published by Oxford University Press. In the book, you investigate the effect jazz music had on the enormous social challenges Europe faced in the aftermath of World War I. And I have to say, I have read it with so much pleasure, so I'm really enthusiastic to speak with you on this topic today. But before we're going to talk about it, I would like to ask you to briefly introduce yourself.
Yes, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's just great to be here. Especially today, which is a day on which we remember the deaths in conflict and war and the aftermath of war. And
it's the 5th of May.
Yeah, it's the 5th of May today. And my book very much sort of looks at the aftermath of war. My name is Rachel Gillett, and I do teach. I often describe myself as I'm a teacher of France, empire, and the history of race and racialization. And I also have a focus on popular culture. So students will often find me popping a clip of some popular meme or music video or something on in class and asking them to kind of reveal and discuss what it shows about France, race, and empire. I am originally from New Zealand, but I've lived in New Zealand, in the UK, in America, and in France, as well as the Netherlands. So I've lived in a lot of different places and observed several different cultures, and I think that also informs my work.
Perhaps it's good to start with a little background information on the situation in Paris between both world wars. For example, you write about black networks. What groups do you mean by this, and how come these different groups were in Paris at that time?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And that is indeed part of the book. The events I describe would not have taken place prior to the war. The war brought huge numbers of colonial subjects and African-Americans into Paris. So at the moment when the book sort of opens, you have particularly the African-American jazz band that comes over with the war, with the black regiments, and it plays in the Jardin des Tuileries in Paris. And this is a snapshot of the kind of city's cultural and political ferment at the time. So you had groups of French colonial subjects from both French West Africa and the French Caribbean. Those were French citizens. You also had Russians who were there because of the situation in Russia. You had a lot of expatriate Americans, both white and black. And of course, you had the people who were there for the Paris Peace Conference. So all of these politicians with their delegations kind of, and the sense was that they were discussing the future of the world as the world had crumbled into pieces. So in the aftermath of World War I, there was this cultural and political ferment, and a lot of it centered on Paris with these groups of people who identified as black, these groups of power brokers, and this fiendish excitement or this feverish excitement about jazz and the new music in the aftermath of a war which seemed to show the old ways having failed completely.
In the book, you show how music and music making were key to anti-colonial and anti-racist cultural politics in interwar Paris. And we will talk about how this worked later. I would like to know more about the aim of your book. Why is it important to pay attention to the link between music and racism and anti-racist politics?
People care about music. Music brings people together and it also drives them apart. And it is often seen as this kind of cultural good or practice that floats above the surface of the political in this sort of classic Marxian analysis or whatever. And yet, because people care about it, because it conveys messages, because it brings people together in groups and mobilizes people, and because it is seen as an expression of identity and identification, this actually makes it political. And I talk about jazz in a lot in the book. And one of the interesting things is, you know, the jazz musicians see jazz as a vehicle to success and to bringing their culture to the world and winning respect, fame, and money. And that is a really important political goal for Black Americans, because this is a population who have habitually been not able to earn money, who've been systemically kind of separated from access to wealth and power and recognition. So jazz has that kind of mobilizing potential for African Americans. For the French Caribbeans, they describe their music, which is similar to jazz but a little bit different, the Beguine, as the soul of the Antilles. Uniquely Caribbean and also in French language. So when you think about identity, when you think about mobilization, you know, music has all these political characteristics, and yet is often seen as trivial or incidental to the big events of the world. And I show in my book that cultural politics matter, and music is part of that.
Thank you for this. First, can you tell us something about the sources you used, and can you also describe how in interwar Paris jazz was linked to racist rhetoric in these sources? Tell us, how did this work?
That's such a great comment, because jazz is racialized in this era. And when I collected information for the book, I was reading all sorts of sources. So I not only read newspaper reports from the mainstream white press at the time, I also read the fledgling Black print journalism in Paris, some of which came from the Caribbean. I was also reading the Black American papers, which were, or papers destined for a Black American audience and written by Black Americans, which were widely circulated. So print journalism, and people commented explicitly on jazz as a vehicle for success, but the white papers also had all of these comments like, jazz is the answer. How could we go back to the concert hall when the strains of classical music have landed us in war, whatever? And jazz is the answer. You can go and enjoy jazz without feeling the horror of the war. But then they also have, and jazz is like this Black music, it's passionate, it's primitive, it's the music of the animals, you know, and some of the negative reviews are the howling of the trumpets is like the braying of a donkey, and the antics of the band leader are like a chimpanzee jumping around. Those are racial commentaries that go right back to the 19th century. Other sources I looked at were the actual music itself, records, record labels, sheet music, and the images on the sheet music covers were also heavily racialized. On one of them that's in the book, you have a figure of a jazz guitar player, but his fingers are bananas. Are a bunch of bananas, and his face is heavily blackened and his lips are huge and red. And that's not even getting to the hypersexualized images of Josephine Baker. But in all of these sources, you see a link between jazz and Blackness. And sometimes that link is very positive. Historically, it's accurate in that jazz is a music that emerges from African-American culture. But in the white mainstream press and in some white thinking, it's also highly racialized in negative ways.
So you just mentioned that the interpretation of jazz was political, and at the same time, Black jazz artists used their music for political purposes. How was music deployed to spread political messages?
I'm going to give you two answers, one from the Black American perspective and one from the French Caribbean and French West African perspective. So Black French, broadly speaking. Black Americans had access to going to Paris through jazz. They were highly employable, highly paid. In fact, because jazz was racialized, even people who didn't know how to play jazz but were Black were seen as authentic jazz performers because of the color of their skin. And that created opportunities. And Black Americans then who went to Paris created a political narrative that portrayed France as a land of liberty, opportunity, colorblindness, and a lesson for America. And they would write these letters back to their communities in America and print them in the Black press that I talked about France is the land of freedom. There is no racial oppression as there is in America. We could all learn from France. And so this was a highly politicized narrative that was broadly spread among Black American communities. And the French loved it, of course. Like, it really suited their purposes as well, this French state. For Black French, they knew this wasn't true. And also, they saw jazz music as perpetuating images of Black people that were sometimes heavily exoticized and primitive, as we see with Josephine Baker and her banana skirt, you know? And one of their responses was to try and promote the Beguine, which is this French Caribbean music, and say, hey, look, we have music too, and it's refined, and it's beautiful, and it expresses a French spirit, a Francophone Caribbean spirit. So that is also a political message, you know, that there are many groups within the broad category of Black, that one of them is French, and that you can be French and Black. And in France, which has often imagined a normative white French male citizen, to say our music is French and it is Black French music and it has a place in the metropole, and it is not jazz, you can't just say it's American, it is French, that is actually a hugely political claim at that time.
Yeah, thank you. And we will touch upon this topic later, more specific. For now, I would like to take one step back and sort of view this from a more helicopter kind of perspective. How to perceive the expression of identities in Black communities, how to perceive that into the context of the political movements after World War I, for example, anti-colonialism. What did new international discourses about anti-racist humanism mean for the political impacts of music making?
There's a lot in that question. So I'm going to describe the anti-colonial networks. And I think an important part of the political context here into which the music landed is the Paris Peace Conference, which I mentioned earlier, the experience of war for the French colonial subjects and citizens who fought for France, the experience of war for the Black Americans who fought for America, for a land in which they do not have full rights, the experience of war for British Caribbeans at that time, later the Windrush generation, for Indians who fought also for Britain. All of the racialized, colonized or subjugated populations who fought for their nation states during the war were exposed to kind of the failures of Western civilization. This is a standard narrative. They all also encountered each other in Europe or in various theaters of war. And Shantanu Das writes about encounters as raising the awareness of rights, of human rights, and particularly when you have Wilson laying down the American president Woodrow Wilson saying, hey, this war was about self-determination. The Black colonial subjects there, or all of the colonial subjects, as well as the Black Americans, were saying, well, how about self-determination for us? So this is a hugely important part of the context within which the anti-colonial networks in Paris emerge. And you do see them founded with rapidity in this era, 1922, 23, 24. They also are being encouraged by the Communist International. And so it's a hugely complex thing. Like, the Communist International is paying money to these anti-colonial networks, both from genuine ideological commitment to independence and also because it helps cement allegiance to a communist ideology. So that's another part of it. And actually, in the book, I had to take great care to differentiate between some of the more middle-class French Caribbeans who really wanted to work within empire and some of the much more radical and radicalized Black Senegalese soldiers, for example, who were very articulate about how badly they'd been treated in war and that France owed them a dette du sang, a blood debt for spilling their blood in a war that was not their own and poorly treating them, not feeding them, not paying them. So that is part of the context within which these anti-colonial movements emerge. And music goes along with that, but we'll talk about that later.
Yes, we will. What you're saying now, what I really like about your book, about the story you tell, that you really differentiate between those groups. And perhaps it's good to talk more about the differences among black groups in Paris, as not to create an image of an homogeneous black group in Paris. Can you elaborate a bit on the tensions between these black groups and to what extent differences were articulated in discussions on music?
Yes. And one of the tensions that often gets lost when we work on race and racialization alone is class. And so you have this very clear group of middle-class, educated, literate French Caribbeans and some Senegalese, French West Africans, Diagne, Blaise Diagne, who are okay still working within empire, but would like full recognition and social, economic, and political inclusion within empire and for everybody. And the French politician Blaise Diagne, kind of from Senegal, is trying to advocate for these rights for all Senegalese who have actually very differential rights, even within this one region at the time. And that is a class and education difference between some of the soldiers who were brought over to France and had some education, but were often then working in factories, either just outside of Paris or in the ports in Marseille. And they're much more working class, and out of the more working class Communist International funded groups comes much more of a kind of independence from France rather than recognition within France. That's just the French context. I could do that rundown and just the French black context. You've also got Algerians there, Tunisians. But this emerges in music, actually. The middle class French, they were called évolué at the time, are actually holding salons, and they are reading black American poetry and writing their own poetry and funding classical music concerts and sort of manifesting civilization. And some of the claims they make for their own music are that it's dignified and serene and beautiful. And for example, it portrays the endless pursuit of man after woman in a graceful and sinuous movement across the dance floor. That's a quote. And then they contrast this to the frenetic jerkings of the Charleston from these Americans. And so, you know, there's a claim that they are dignified, evolved, and civilized, and the French should include them for that. Not for that reason, but that's one of the things they're proving worth on. In some of the more radicalized working class groups, there's actually a rejection of music as frivolous until its fundraising potential is seen. And then the working class groups begin to throw these big musical balls where, like, people will pay for a ticket, they'll dance to the Beguine or to jazz, they employ a lot of musicians. Everybody's happily dancing. They struggle to get women along, but everybody's paid their membership, you know, their ticket price. And then in the middle of the ball, somebody will stride on stage and give a huge political speech about, like, the French, we've got to kick them out. And so music gets mobilized actually in a very directly political way,
wow,
as well as through the politics of identification.
Thank you. In chapter 5 of your book, you write about how various black groups found ways to overcome their differences to combat fascism and racism in the early 1930s. And one of the topics you write about in this chapter is the campaign against Benito Mussolini's invasion, the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. What's the significance of the music made to support Ethiopians against Italian aggression?
You know, chapter 5 is the culmination of an argument that I make through the whole book, which is to show how these groups who did identify on the basis of a shared kind of racial oppression nevertheless had differences and came together at certain times but were deeply divided at other times. And the invasion of Ethiopia in 1935 is one of the moments at which they come together and they transcend these divisions. And again, the fundraising potential of music is relevant here, but so is the visibility and solidarity of music making. And so, actually, it's hilarious when you read the police surveillance records of the fundraising concerts and also the black print reviews of the fundraising concerts. They're like, and we were so impassioned to show how terrible this invasion is. The event didn't make much money, but we were all there singing together to like protest the invasion of Ethiopia. And that is a little bit of the flavor of it. And I think that the concert that I reference is one moment. There's also this jazz band that rename themselves after the Ethiopian kings, you know, the Trois Negus or something. There's just absolute widespread outrage among these varying black and colonial communities, and they see what it's going to mean. Like and one of the fascinating things is actually in one of the British jazz magazines, they're very clear that Hitler and Mussolini are fascists and that jazz can stand together with black people against this onset of fascism, which seems like a really sort of 2020 kind of, I don't know, a very modern sensibility, but it was absolutely there. So to answer your question, I think music actually physically did bring people together. It also provided these moments of visibility and solidarity that were also present in other ways, in the print journalism, in street protests, in the reporting across all the various, you know, English, French, American newspapers, and they would report on each other's protests. And so there's this whole cultural level where, again, you see the cultural politics of solidarity fueled by the outrage at this unjust invasion. And Ethiopia, of course, has tremendous symbolism, both political and cultural, because it's the only non-colonized country in Africa at that stage, or the most visible one. And so that adds to the layer of outrage, and so does the cultural significance of Ethiopia as a cradle of civilization. And you'll find black print networks constantly from the 1800s forward referring to Ethiopia as a Christian and civilized nation because of the cultural power that has to offset perceptions of black peoples as primitive, savage, and hypersexualized and unchristian. And so, you know, it's not just the music, it's also the tremendous cultural politics and actual solidarity that accumulate in response to the outrage of the invasion.
Wow, wonderful, thanks. Last question about this book. In your book, you elaborate upon the cultural activism of many, many individuals, and you write, and I quote this, their work threw into question long-standing ideas about what Frenchness was or should be. And I was wondering which individual touched you the most, and please tell us about their story.
I mean, I love them all. There's this moment in my preface where I was a little more experimental in the writing than historians sometimes are. And I think I write, I would love to have sipped a cocktail at Bricktop's bar, to have gossiped gently about Josephine Baker, and then to have attended a salon, a black musical and intellectual salon with the Nardal sisters, and yet later on shared their anger at not being included in these male anti-colonial networks. And so the figures there are, of course, Bricktop, this incredible red, maybe she's my favorite, this incredible redhead, fellow redhead. And she's a nightclub owner. And she's like such a snob. Like she has all these very wealthy, very royal people there. The Prince of Wales is jamming at 2 a.m. with the jazz musicians. But Bricktop continually provides a home for black American musicians coming to Paris, and she holds Christmas dinners for them, and she receives their mail for them, and she posts it for them, and she lends them money. And so she becomes a central node in, and her place becomes a central node in the network of success that is so powerful for black Americans. But the Nadal sisters are French Caribbeans, and Paulette is so courageous, one of the first women at the Sorbonne. She writes this amazing thesis. She's very middle class, but they open their home to fellow Black, French, and American intellectuals. She's corresponding with Alain Locke, you know, and trying to translate his work into French so that they can build this Black French humanism. And throughout the interwar period, she continues to do this. She opens her home. She's writing letters for the Ethiopian invasion. She is trying to manifest respectability and humanism in the face of the very exoticized images of Josephine Baker. And to do that work, to show that she is a Francophone, educated Black woman in the heart of the metropole who represents French values. And actually later on, she tries to return to Martinique as Vichy takes over, and her ship is bombed and she loses a leg. But she continues after the war back in Martinique to build women's political unions. After the Second World War.
Yeah.
So she has to return, and they're quite conservative women's political networks, but she also works for the UN, and she continues to build choirs that sing Black American music and French Caribbean music and express this kind of Black cultural politics of both solidarity and difference. And I just think Paulette's, like, great. She's really cool in her own way. So those would be my two. Bricktop and Paulette, I think, exemplify some of the people in the book.
And then the last question. In March, the Dutch Research Agenda granted you funding for the project Representing Europe, or Representing Europe, tell me later, popular representations of diversity and belonging. Bob, tell us about this. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. And actually, it is in some ways a natural continuation of the book. And I pronounce it as Representing Europe, but the pun is intentional because I want to both, we want to both represent how European identity has been portrayed in the past and actually some of the limitations and damage that has done, and then represent Europe as a space of diaspora but also belonging. And in many ways, this is the same work that Paulette Nadal was doing. You know, she felt French and European as well as Caribbean and Black. And that is both diversity and a problematic belonging. So I think it's some of the same thematic connections. And then I worked on jazz in the book, but as I worked on it, so many students would say to me, oh, well, you should think about hip hop. Because it's this same thing of this Afro-diasporic music that nevertheless is developed locally in many places to express local political discontents through music, through expression, or just to express commercial success, you know, in a very flamboyant way. The project picks up on these themes with hiphophuizen throughout the Netherlands, who also find these themes resonant. Are the communities amongst whom they work European? Are they Dutch? How have they been included? How do they feel they belong in representations of Dutch culture and in social, economic, and political ways in the Netherlands? And then one of the, I think, beauties of the project is that we also move on from some of the fields of success that Afro-diasporic peoples have often enjoyed in Europe, and these tend to be sports and music historically. And there are some stereotyping and racialized elements to that, right? Sports and music are both of the body and can both be seen as sort of quite physical activities. And that has had some stereotyping limitations, but also opened up opportunities. So in the project, we look at that historically. We also think about how it has this really positive vibe, but also these limitations. What have sports and music done? Who is playing on the field and who is coaching? Who's getting the big bucks as a manager? And then the third, like, super important plank of the project is to think about education, because the classroom is one of the biggest places where we learn about representations, where we learn about identification, and where we can either feel we belong or not, and feel alienated from the society in which we live and move and have our being, or do not.
Yeah.
And so the themes of belonging, of who belongs, of how we see that, and how, you know, these Afro-diasporic kind of peoples and fields of enterprise have shaped Europe, are European, and yet that has not always been recognized, are present in my book and are present in the project. And I'm just really lucky that people throughout the Netherlands found this true and compelling and worked with me. And that's the beauty of the grant, is that it's not me, actually, it's this incredible team. And we're looking forward to re-presenting Europe and exploring this theme of belonging in the next 5 years.
Oh, wow, it sounds very exciting. I cannot wait to hear more about it, but I'm sure that will be in the future. Thank you so much. You really illuminated us so we can understand how music mobilized people for certain cases, for anti-racism. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, anybody wants to talk about their work. And you just made this such a pleasurable conversation. Thank you for reading it. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
Thank you.